We are here at the COP15 in Montreal, and I'm here with Christine von Weizsäcker from EcoEuropa, who's going to tell us a bit about what we are looking out for at this COP and what are some of the main issues. So thank you so much for speaking with me. Can we start with an introduction? What kind of work do you do at EcoEuropa?
Oh, that's very simple. I'm their president. EcoEuropa exists since 1976, when some people in Europe, the fathers and mothers of the environmental movement, thought that perhaps the ecological crisis and all the trouble with nature is not a national issue only. So they sat together, and they were writers and politicians and farmers and scientists, and they sat for 3 years discussing, and then they came up with, you're not going to have ecology without democracy and North-South justice. And we need very little money, which doesn't make us dependent and lets us still focus on policies and not on fundraising.
So here we are. We are the COP. The official COP has not actually begun. We are here at the open-ended working group. You know, it seems very quiet in the hallways. Can you first begin by explaining to me what is the difference between the meetings that are happening now and the official COP that's going to start in a few days?
Well, to put it bluntly, the event that the journalists are talking about and that is called the COP is the result of a series of negotiations. So more or less 85% to 90% of the text are finalized before the COP starts, before the big shots come. And so being present here in the preparatory negotiations is absolutely crucial, because if we lose good text here, it's lost in the COP and there will be no decision on it. So the real fights are here. The COPs only have the final trade-offs between different issues. It's called open-ended working group, preparing a text for a global biodiversity framework, which is more or less a 10-year plan. It should have started in 2020, but the COP couldn't take place. So it's from 2020 to 2030. So it only leaves us 8 years to achieve something against this terrible, terrible, dreadful biodiversity loss, which is going to really be violent against many people, and mainly poor people around the world who depend on direct, what is called ecosystem services, food, water, shelter, clean air, health, their diets, their whole incomes depend on intact ecosystems. And these people tell me, governments failed us, the market failed us. It's only Mother Nature that keeps us alive.
And so what are some of the issues that are being decided now before the official COP begins? I mean, people have called the COP, the Paris Agreement for Biodiversity, and as you're saying, the things that are decided now will be important for the next 10 years. So what are some of the major issues that you are following in these few days before the COP starts?
One thing, as I've already pointed out, is the rights of indigenous peoples, smallholder farmers, family farmers, local people. And so in a way, the solution is not going to be here, neither in Paris nor in Montreal. The solution will be on the ground. But the decisions here make it easier for good people to quote, if there are good decisions here, and bad for bad people to quote if it's bad decisions. So the main point is that, for instance, smallholder farmers can say, no, we are not backward. There is a gigantic international agreement by 196 countries out of the 198 existing ones
We're just outside one of the rooms here, and a lot of the civil society groups are very concerned about Target 17 in the text of that is being discussed at the moment. Can you tell me a bit about what is Target 17?
Well, Target 17 is basically, I have to start with the promises of genetic engineering. I was involved in the first round of genetic engineering, and what didn't they promise about? There is going to be no hunger around the world, agriculture with no pesticides, the amount of pesticides increased, and recently, in the past 2 years, hunger increased terribly again, as the Human Development Report tells us. So this failed. It's a few crops, basically for the world market, and now we have a new round of promises. CRISPR-Cas, which is an elegant tool for research, is now being used as promising. We are going to fight droughts, we are going to fight floods, we are going to have the seeds that can withstand everything, we're going to fight climate change, so you don't have to change your consumption and production patterns. We promise business as usual. So you have this big wave of promises of new genetic technology like CRISPR-Cas and similar ones. And this is being dealt here because the convention has an article about addressing the risks of modern biotechnology, and it ended up in a protocol, meaning real obligations to states. And now nobody, of course, could think of synthetic biology then. It's new. So the question is whether you include this with the precautionary principle, meaning better safe than sorry. We wouldn't be here if our ancestors hadn't applied the precautionary principle. None of us would sit here. So to look closely, to assess, what are these promises? Are they only promises, or is it really useful? And for this, we need horizon scanning, technology assessment, monitoring, because some of the issues you don't know beforehand, it only shows later. So this is a very important issue, because if people believe in techno fixes, they're not going to change, neither for climate change nor for maintaining intact ecosystems, because they're being promised a techno fix, a way out, and can lean back. So people do like to lean back, not to have to say, what am I going to do for myself, my children, my grandchildren? I'm old enough to really have grandchildren, 13 grandchildren, as a matter of fact. So I have a lot of reason to be here.
So the Target 17 in the text of that was just being discussed is about, or what you would like to see is to have something that mentions assessing new technologies before they come into being, for example, synthetic biology. Can you give an example of some of these technologies that may be pushed onto countries or communities without assessment or monitoring?
Well, I mean, in Europe, there is an attempt to exempt these precision breeding technologies. So they use PR terms. Who doesn't want to be precise? And breeding sounds so nice, it doesn't look like test tubes and very expensive machines. One of the examples, of course, is to say we get rid of malaria in the world. One of the tools they have is to say we include genes that make the offspring sterile.
Gene drives.
That's called gene drives. That forces populations out of existence. You would say, well, yes, the malaria mosquitoes, nice. Some other insects we don't like, and ticks we don't like. And firstly, gene drives don't hold all the time, so it's going to come back. Secondly, if you have no mosquitoes in the water, you're not going to have fish. It really would be a task to look all the influences things have.
Before they're released.
Well, sometimes with some things you could release and then have time to look, but not with gene drives. Once they're out of control. I mean, this is what scientists already are thinking about. We delete all breeds, all old-fashioned breeds from the surface of the earth. We just put them into collections somewhere.
And breeds of what, animals or?
Breeds of animals, of plants, crops, domesticated animals. And we drive all this old stuff out. We all don't like certain things momentarily, but we are not allowed to kill them.
So I was in this room just a few minutes ago, and a lot of the discussion was about UNDROP and UNDRIP. Can you tell me what these stand for, these terms?
Well, these terms are very dear terms. They sound funny, UNDROP, UNDRIP, never heard of it. UNDRIP means United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. You may remember that at the very beginning of the United Nations, which really was a peace effort of humanity after the Second World War, you had the General Declaration on Human Rights. And by being mentioned often, by being used in court decisions, it became more and more solid. Now it's common international law. There are similar declarations now recently on the rights of indigenous peoples, which is UNDRIP. And even more recently, you have UNDROP, which means the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and People Living in Rural Areas. Most people who protect and sustainably use ecosystems, biological diversity, they are poor people living in local communities. They know how to do it. And they are deeply threatened by modern market mechanisms. They lose lands. They lose the territories that they really protect. And they very often protect them at the cost of their lives sometimes, better than the national protected areas. You can see it, for instance, in Mexico. Areas guarded by indigenous peoples have a closed canopy. The forest cover, the leaf cover is intact. Protected areas have huge logging holes. It would be terrible if the tradition of robbing land from indigenous peoples and violating their rights and turning them into protected areas were only tourists and scientists and filmmakers can go into. So one of the big attempts here is to please stop the conflict between human rights and environmental protection. And if we lose that one, we really are lost, because if we lose the trust of the local communities, their creativity, their practices, their attention to detail, their solutions, we are lost.
What do you hope will be the outcome after all these days and after the COP? What's your hope for this particular COP15?
My hope is that we are weak. We don't have so much power. We don't have so many media.
When you say we, who do you mean?
The civil society, the farmers, the indigenous peoples. We are weak partners, but we have friendships. We have trust amongst each other. We are very attentive, and even slight wins, sometimes surprising wins. Every one of our wins is a surprise against very strong forces that run against it. Maybe used by other people to make life a little easier for them. I never, as a scientist, of course, I could say, do a prognostics, say what will be the outcome. Will it be positive? I don't know. And if I would run into thinking about will we win or not, I would not be attentive enough to really look at the small chances we have. And there are a surprising lot of decent people, even in government. I mean, if you would look at the power relationships between all those huge numbers of corporations, lobbyists sitting around here in Montreal, you would say, well, it's not going to be. But, I mean, wouldn't you take the smallest chance if you could help one of your grandchildren?